Well, thanks, Melina. Thanks, I mean, the poems there previously were excellent as well. Thanks for those. Superb. Well done. Okay. But maybe we can just. That'll give you. Perfect. So this poem, it highlights the fact that being born in the worst part of town is a blessing. Milltown Cemetery, Belfast, March 16th, 1988. The last of the three coffins had just been lowered when the first grenade exploded. I was blown 12 feet away, yet landed on my back unhurt. Over the PA, a voice called out to get down. The crowd of mourners and journalists scattered. Some were gathering themselves from grave plots, underwater nails booming in the deep of their heads. A woman was carried past, her face masked in blood. Another grenade exploded. Pistol shots rang out. An overweight man with black fuzzy hair and a thin beard appeared out in front of the crowd, holding a 9mm Browning pistol in his right hand. He raised both hands triumphantly up into the air, one fisted, one pistoled, inciting the crowd to come on. His mouth muted by the din, fish gasped inaudible insults as he produced another grenade and lobbed it into the air. The sea of people parted as it sank, and the dull sound of the explosion lifted a cloud of dust into the overcast sky. Film crews lay spread-eagled behind gravestones. Women were screaming, men were shouting, the gunman was smiling. He began firing from his left to right in a steady line across the crowd, causing a sweeping domino effect like a Mexican wave as one by one the mourners ducked behind the headstones. I waited, then ducked as he leveled his pistol at me. I held my face to the inscription on someone's headstone, their life surmised into two monumental dates. As the wave fell away to my left, with the gunshots tracing its fatal arc after the falling crest. Before standing up, I stole a glance over the headstone. The gunman had turned and was running towards the motorway, where a white RUC van was parked on the grass verge. A group of people chased after him, hers bolting after the greyhound. The gunman stopped to turn and fire. The people chasing him dodged bullets like boxers weaving fists. The RUC van drove off. With no bullets left, no grenades exhausted, the gunman ran onto the deserted motorway, chased by three angry men. At the graveside, film crews scrambled out from behind their protective tombstones. Protective, frantic for interviews, cameras rolling. A tall, blonde presenter for the BBC, with her microphone held out like a pistol, turned to me and demanded, "What did you see?" As I turned away, I told her what anyone from there in those days would say. I saw nothing. Thank you. There were five assassination attempts on my father's life, and this poem was inspired by the third. I stepped into my father's shoes. The moment he stepped out from his off-license doorway onto the pavement and stood next to a lamppost. It was nighttime, but the street light cast a yellow haze over the area as gunman number two stepped out of a doorway three doors down and walked towards my father, my unarmed father, while reaching his right hand into the inside pocket of his coat. When he drew his hand back out, it was empty. The killer stood 6 feet away, my father said, and the expression on his face was one of wonder, as though gunman number two thought he was a ghost standing before him, bathed in the yellow shimmer of the streetlight. Gunman number two was no amateur. This was meant to be the 10th that he and gunman number one were to add to their kill list. So why didn't he take out his gun and shoot the target? But if we hold it there and rewind a few moments to the beginning of this assassination attempt, we will see my father trying to lock up for the night as gunman number one steps out of the darkness and presses a Mauser pistol into my father's chest, then tries to force him back inside the off-license, where he can shoot my father without being witnessed. But as gunman number one steps forward, my father steps to the side, and with his one famous jiu-jitsu move, the flick and spin, the Mauser flies out into the street, followed by ungunned number one, who then gathers himself from the gutter and runs up the street and around the corner. And this is the moment, many years later, the same age as my father was on that night, that I step into my father's shoes and then step out onto the pavement and stand next to the lamppost. It is nighttime, but the street light casts a yellow haze over the area, and the killer approaches. Thanks, man. So Paul asked me to, somebody handed in this letter to Paul, so he asked me if I would read it out. It's for somebody called Joe, so if Joe's here, he needs a step forward. Dear Joe, I didn't mean to kill him. We were drinking all day. We were living in that one room for 3 months after you left. It was the end of a long, dark winter. We had 5 sausages. Who was getting 3? Who was getting 2? I whacked him over the head with a frying pan and ate all 5. Then called the cops. I had every intention of handing myself in until I heard the sirens whirling bad news out on the street. Ice blue flashing through the window. I bolted down the fire escape and headed for the hills. I used one of our canoes to get upriver. The sky spun around my head like a prostitute's skirt, and the stars flashed like lice and flitted around a swollen gonorrhea moon. But I rode through the night until I got here. I'm in that place, Joe, my place, my second home, as you used to say, the cabin we use when we're fishing. I gave this letter to a trapper rowing down river who gave me his word that he would deliver. And I was on our neem tree today, Joe. Birds must have pecked his neem off. There is a hole on the side of the tree, like a gouged out eye, where his neem used to be. And the ghost of the old wild horse is still here, Joe. As I watched it run through the leafless winter trees, I couldn't stop thinking, is he with shades on the spectral wastes, drifting through endless day? When the kettle boils, I hear him neeming, I hear him screaming. As the train rumbles by, I feel him nearing. When I look out the cracked window of the shack, it looks like the outskirts of my own brain, the slum end of my mind. Tonight there is no moon, Joe. It's hiding out like I am, behind a sky full of bullet holes. Everything is hypnotized by the wind, Joe. There is no control. Bahamas machine droning along like a fly in the wind. I left a canoe for you, Joe, submerged upside down in the water under the bridge. If you get this letter, Joe, roll me up some whiskey. Please, Joe, roll me up some whiskey. I'm not sure if Joe is here, but it seems like he gave me another letter. RuPaul. Might explain things. The burial of 10 to 2 blue. No one looks for the dead among the dead. That was the solution. So I waited until it got dark, and when I found the lidded over grave the grave diggers dug earlier, I began digging. Hear nothing, I told myself. Not the night birds, not your own breathing. Nothing till the spade hits wood. In this silent darkness, I was a giant. The shoulder of the spade was a rooftop, my foot crushing it down through eaves as the blade pressed into the clay. When I climbed out from the turmeric soil, I dragged 10 to 2 blue's corpse to the edge and dropped him onto the closed lid of the coffin, then refilled the grave and patted the barrow down as the grave diggers had left it that morning. Before leaving the graveside, I paused to gather my breath. The grave tops looked like the rooftops of a steepled holy city, grave crosses rising up from 100 crosses whose bell towers were the hilted handles of knives, the blades driven down into the starved ribs of cobbled streets. As I looked over the city of the dead, I felt myself rise, exalted, a holy man at the edge of a defeated desert, returning to bowed disbelievers. I flung the spade into the gaping dark. It whirled through the captured air like the wings of rooks in the belfry, and I walked towards the horseshoe gateway, with the gate with the great tidal hum of the universe washing over me. So this also happened. The crows. It was obvious from the way the crows came stumbling over the hill as though running along an old track in the woods, through trees cut down by time, lived and died by others I heard of in stories, told by my grandmother to my mother, to my sister, to my brother, who then told me over the phone in the middle of the night, in case he forgot like the thousand other times his memory let him down, when the dawn washed over his brain's estuary, like the crows now wash overhead along the tree-lined ghost road through the air's invisible ground, like wounded soldiers en route home from the frontline trenches, flapping the black wings of their youth to stave off the winter that follows them and follows them, that knows where they live, that knows where we all live, and the very second we're all due home. Lake Michigan. As I went outside and looked across Lake Michigan, the February rain in seconds numbed the skin on my face while the winds ran through the trees, surrounding the cabin like wolves at the end of a bad winter when the only taste of blood they remember is the old and the runt of the litter, and the sky overhead was plummeting to level the earth as I ran back inside, barred the door, and twisted the deadlock into the frame, as I do back during the troubles when the sound of screeching tires corralled rioters into the open waste ground at the back of our house, and I'd shut the curtains and hit the deck as they sped up the back path, the rioters and the armoured police jeeps, like the heel-filled winds that blew in off Lake Michigan, the echo of them battering the ground the way the police battered those rioters, trapped in the dead end outside our kitchen window back in Belfast. Their howls, the scream, their howls the same as those winds that ran through the teeth, their howls the same as those winds that ran through the trees, all teeth and no lips at the dead end of winter, with the only taste of blood the hunter wants is the old and the runt of the litter. Thanks a lot, man. This next poem's called Mosaic. And I did actually hear in the last poems, the word broken coming up a lot. And it just must be one of those words. And I have it in here quite a bit as well. But Mosaic. She realized she was watching TV with her dead brother when he reached his hand through hers for a building block, the clairvoyant said, as I headed out the back door to smash Delph to add to the mosaic spreading across the garden wall like a virus. It was one of those morning TV shows, two hosts, a male hedging his bets and a female who wants to believe, sitting on cream couches, smiling all ears at the special guest, the clairvoyant, a bright-eyed but ruffled bird in her prime, whose blue eyes came back to me as I stuck the blue shards to the garden wall. And to see them glint, I highlighted them with the black fragments of my favourite coffee cup that dropped to the floor when I remembered the dream where my mother was alive but didn't recognise me after all these years, like I was someone at the reception in a hotel foyer, checking in while she was checking out. My reflection in her dark sunglasses as sad as it is now in the lens-shaped shard stuck to the garden wall, hiding an eye that remembers me but doesn't recognize where from. And I wanted to go back to see if the clairvoyant's brother had been letting on and had known all along, and that my mother had been playing the same game. But I stayed on, adding broken fragments to the mosaic, because things are made memorable by their breaking. This is called the Our Earthenware Jug. Our Earthenware Jug. I thought of the morning we leaned over the harbour walls and looked down at our two squiggly faces on the rippling water. When I looked through the kitchen window at the yellow gorse, after I had spread the broken fragments of the earthenware jug we bought somewhere in Connemara over the sideboard, so that I could bind it back together again with melted gold. Then, as I filled the crucible with nuggets and plugged it in, I saw you again, holding a yellow flower of gorse to my nose, telling me to breathe in the scent of coconut. And after doing so, I took the flower and rubbed it between my thumb and forefinger, a velvet ear, like your ear when on the verge of sleep, the dimmer switch I'd used to send you off into the dark lands, safe in your knowing that I was holding the lantern. Then I picked up the first broken fragment, a gorse flower, poured a thin strip of melted gold along its jagged edge, joined it to the shard that held the flower's stem, and pressed them both together. The gilded seam shone like a golden road between flower and stem, like the road we drove along when we left the harbour, with two high banks of yellow gorse on either side, the dark road behind us sinking down into yellow fire. I had dreamed of you the night before. That was why I took the box down from the top of the cupboard and spread out the fragments of the earthenware jug, the jug we bought somewhere in Connemara. that you flung against the wall before finally leaving to drive on out of the broken road, our road. When I finished gilding the jug packed together again, I held its remade body up to the sunlight. It was somehow bound with a radiant understanding of how all things break. So, if you're out there listening, if you can somehow tune in through the radio silence of the intervening years, then know this. Instead of the cracked roads between broken shards, our earthenware jug is now traversed by roads of gold, and it looks just as the brochure promised, all the more beautiful for having been broken. This next poem is called The Year I Painted the Humber Bridge. I did as well. That's a total lie, of course, but that's just said. The year I painted the Humber Bridge. Given two choices, I chose the night shift. So every evening, round about 10 o'clock, I stepped into a little cage to be hoisted up into the air, to paint my way along the strands strung from the bowed cables like the strings of a harp, but imagining the sound I couldn't hear as I strummed the paintbrush along the wound pleats, I saw how the starry sky could hear it by the way the moon's face glowed when it appeared high over the estuary like a freeze-framed football kicked by the ghost children of the tides, and by how the banks of silt gleamed light for the herons hunting the channel as the symphony hummed from the strands night after night, month after month, until those self-same children of the tides had kicked the moon across the estuary, and the little cage lowered me down for the last time to take with me back out into the daytime world the music of what we no longer hear. Thanks, Lily. So I think I'm actually finishing with this last poem, and this is a poem about biting off too much, and before you know it, there's a hook in what you've bitten off. The pups in the bog hole. I poured the milk into the cup of hot black tea until the surface clouded over and lightened with coils of steam like the genie of memory rising out from the uncorked bottle of the forgotten. The half-brown, the turf-brown tea settled at the brim of the cup, silent as the guilty bog water that brimmed the wide bog hole I had walked away from many years ago when I was a child. It was a deep bog hole, a blind eye, beside a bare oak tree whose branches, like exposed nerve endings, signposted its fatal spot in the middle of the vast gouged out turf fields. As I returned that day to Uncle Frank's pub on the sea road, through the coconut scent of the yellow wind bushes, the palms of my hands were still stinging, reddened, branded by the weight on the coarse fabric of the turf sack. And all around was the echoing liquid call of the curlew, marking out the hollow tent of the sky, the amphitheatre that had been listening all along to the puppy yelps muffled in the turf sack, and my footsteps dragging them to the bog hole. The mute colosseum of the firmament gasped as the tossed sack whirred through the air, hit the bull's eye of the bog hole, bobbed, seemed to float, then slowly sank. As I turned and fled, my Footsteps were lighter, but the naivety of my bravery weighed down my outsized Wellington boots with a heavier tread. In my pocket was the 50 pence piece, the Judas coin Uncle Frank had given me to do the man's job he didn't have time to do. And overhead, the crowded audience of the sky darkened in disbelief. As I sit here years later and lifted the teacup to my lips, I realize I have been bringing sacks to that bog hole ever since. The pups of what I cannot reveal to anyone, pushing the visage of their key of art paws out through the sacking. And in my head, I can still hear Uncle Frank's well-greased till shoot open like a bullet and hit home with a ring. And I still see, beside the bog hole, on the wizened trunk of that burnt oak tree, the eye of a twisted knot stirring out like the drowned. Thank you very much. Thank you.